Now, last time I gave you an overview of the Renaissance, and I talked at the end about the political pessimism, which in a way forced the creative instincts of the nation into artistic and literary channels. We saw that the classics were to revive the virtue of man in an Italy where all virtue seemed lacking, an Italy of despots, an Italy of mercenary armies, in Italy where the lust for power seemed to dominate all economic and political activities. Now it was Niccolò Machiavelli who tried to build a bridge between the kind of moral regeneration through art and literature about which the poets like Petrarch talked and politics. To build a bridge between that kind of revival and politics. Machiavelli's dates, and that is important, are 1469 to 1527. You will notice in these dates, and I will come back to it, that between 1469 and 1527, he was just a little older contemporary of Luther. They were contemporaries. Now, unlike Petrarch or Dante, Machiavelli was an active statesman. He had occupied a leading political position in Florence until the Medici became the despots and exiled a Machiavelli to his country home. It is in exile from a Florence become a despotism that he wrote down his famous Meditations. These were derived from the politics of Florence. What he wrote in his most famous books, The Prince and the Discourses, were the kind of things politicians were discussing in Florence around 1500. But what Machiavelli did is he gave this discussion among the politicians of Florence clarity and form. He sat him down in a clear and precise form. Now, what was discussed, obviously, were the doldrums of the times, the despots, the fossilization of the social structure, the decline of social mobility. Machiavelli, in the end, saw the prince as the only active thing in Italy. And he tried to revive the civic spirit through the stress on a citizen army, thus his interest in war and the art of war. The Medici had come to power on the swords of a foreign power. They had been installed or supported by a foreign power. So Machiavelli, from the beginning, as was general, as I tried to explain last time, stressed a militia, was interested in the art of war, not for conquest, but to revive the civic spirit. But that was only a minor thing. He really wanted to revive a political consciousness which seemed dead. This political consciousness was for him the essence of things. He vacillated between deep pessimism and sudden optimism about the future. The famous ending of The Prince is Machiavelli the optimist, but he was just as often a kind of pessimist. But the thing about Machiavelli is that he became more than a man of his time. That is why he raked so much attention from us. Because his name became a slogan in Europe, denoting a new attitude towards politics, the consciousness, if you like, of a new attitude towards politics. That is the point. And it is this new attitude towards politics which forms, in a way, the crux of Machiavelli's influence. Now, Machiavelli, as I said before, was both a humanist and concerned with politics. He combines both. What he exalts from the beginning, as the humanists did, as the Protestant reformers will do, is the community. What we need, he says, really, as the humanists said, is a new and meaningful community. We now live in the age of the despots. There is no community. There's only fragmentation. There's only dictatorship. There's only degeneration. There's only decline. And so what we need is really the new civic spirit by which the humanists and Machiavelli meant a new kind of meaningful community. You will read this in Petrarch as well. It is general for the humanists. And that community for Machiavelli must be a political community, not just a cultural community, as it was for so many of the poets and artists of the Renaissance, but a political community. And so he is led to his fundamental conclusion. His fundamental conclusion is that politics are separate from all other spheres of human activities. That for those who take part in politics, the demands of politics, the demands which politics make, must be put above all other demands. Only in this way can politics be the road to a renewal, the road to a restructuring of society. Now, why this emphasis on politics as separate and above all other spheres of human activity? He saw the community as a political society. And he saw this community as political society, as a political body having its own laws of existence. Now, this was totally novel and new, and I shall come back to that. But with this viewpoint of the political community having its own laws of existence, we must add this. The well-being of any society, and it can only be well if politics dominate. Politics in the sense of a community, the politics of participation, as we would say today. The well-being of this society depends less on its institutions than on the kind of spirit which stands behind this community. And that spirit which stands behind the community, that spirit must be a single-minded willpower. A single-minded willpower which gives to man a heightened sense of the common good. A heightened sense of the common good, which makes him focus on the community itself, on the community and its well-being. Thus, Machiavelli, from the very beginning, and we must understand this, puts forth an ideal commonwealth. An ideal commonwealth is a unified body of men, which acts with the strength and willpower necessary for political success. Such a commonwealth, how can it come about? How can it exist? For Machiavelli was pessimistic about his world that he saw around him, a world dominated by change and struggle, a world dominated by despots and degeneration. Now, Machiavelli saw the world as constantly dominated by change and struggle, constantly dominated by it. And he had a word to characterize change and struggle, and I can't obviously get it on the blackboard, but it doesn't matter. It's fortune, but not fortune as we or the Christian world sees it. Fortune to which I shall come, where God either punishes you or praises you according to your morality. Fortune for Machiavelli is constant change with which any politics will have to cope, with which any building of an ideal commonwealth has to cope. Machiavelli was in this sense a relativist. There is in such a world dominated by change and fortune, he tells us, no single best action, no singly laid down best form of government. What matters is the spirit, the political spirit, which leads to success. But the political spirit must be informed by a relativism, for otherwise it will not be able to cope with the constant change and constant flux of fortune. There is no single best action. Now, all of this said, what can we say about a deeper level of his ideas which resulted into such attitudes? Now, first of all, about what I have said, his method is very important. For taking this view of what you might call the autonomy of politics in a changing world, politics is the final morality in itself, because what you're about to do is to build a good commonwealth, and a good commonwealth is a political activity. His method. For he carries the Renaissance to a point of complete realism. But that realism is not, and I shall come back to that, immoral. Christianity thought it was. Why did they think it was immoral? Because maxims of Christian morality must be judged by their consequences, precisely as any other institutions or customs must be judged by their consequences. If a maxim of Christian morality is politically harmful, this must be pointed out, lest it leads to what we would call political disaster. Now, within a Christian frame of reference, this was indeed a revolutionary. Lots of people had said it, but nobody had ever written it. For eternal values are not eternal at all. Eternal values might have bad consequences, and therefore they must be scrapped. Morals, in the accepted Christian sense, are relegated on the same plane as any other custom and institutions. The main thing is the good commonwealth. The main thing is to cope with fortune through politics. Otherwise, you won't get the good commonwealth. And moral maxims are beside the point. Now, contrast that with a saying of his contemporary, Martin Luther. Martin Luther once said this: if you deny God in one thing, you deny God in all. That's just the opposite of Machiavelli. If you deny God in one thing, you deny God in all. Because if it is political, wholly harmful, if it is necessary to cope with fortune, you have to deny the idea, the maxim of Christian morality. Now, what is involved here is something I told you last time with the humanists: the sense that Christianity has failed politically, with the rise of the despots, with all the things that went on, just as Petrarch, after all, and all the humanists were imbued with the failure of Christianity. But that political failure was also a moral failure to all the humanists, and they tried to substitute the morality of Plato for the morality of Christ. For the political failure of Christianity, as they saw it, to produce the good society, was also for them a moral failure. Machiavelli therefore came to see Christianity as either something that could on occasion be politically useful, or something that on occasion had to be scrapped because it was politically bad. In any case, it was artificial. It was not for him, in a way, an eternal value in this sense. As he put it, very strikingly, the sins which ruin states are military and political sins, not moral sins. In other words, again, the autonomy of politics to build a good society and not of Christian morality. Secondly, this does not mean that Machiavelli is without morality. Indeed, as I told you before, what counts for successful politics, for the successful coping with fortune, is the spirit which stands behind politics. And the spirit which stands behind politics is the highest good, and it is a morality. It will not surprise you that he took that morality from Rome. The highest morality is not the Christian morality. It is the Roman morality of the Roman Republic, the morality of the citizen, the morality of civic participation, the morality for which, above all, Cicero in his speeches stood. And through that participation, through that Roman morality, you get what Machiavelli called the well-ordered state, the kind of well-ordered states of which the Renaissance had so few, or indeed, from his position, hardly any to show. The well-ordered state would bring out the goodness of man. The well-ordered state would bring out the basic capabilities of man. But this well-ordered state is only achieved then through politics, through the political morality, which he saw in the Roman Republic, the morality of political participation. For what do you need? What is the greatest obstacle? Christianity, to be sure, but above all, the passions of men. And here again, he does something which is quite commonplace. From now on in with the classical revival, most political theorists, most people who want to build a better society, will see in the great obstacle to this society the passions of men. That goes back to the Stoics, to Greek ideas, that the passions are the obstacles to the good society. But what, says Machiavelli, is the greatest passion that man has? It is man's passion for power, man's passion for ruling. And this, of course, the passion for power, the passion for ruling, he saw exemplified in the Italian despots. Not surprisingly, the passion for power, the passion for ruling, the kind of passion of man which stands in the way of constructing the well-ordered state which will fulfill man's capability and bring out the best in man, as it were. Now, how do you overcome them? How do you overcome man's passion? Well, says Machiavelli, things are so bad right now. There's hardly a good man left, because in the age of the despots, the passion for power, the passion for ruling has infected all of society. And before we can have the well-ordered state, the kind of spirit, we need the right kind of man. The right kind of man, he also defined. The right kind of man is the man who has virtù. And this you spell without an E, because it's not a Christian concept of virtue. Virtù. Who is the man who has virtù? The man who you really need to bring about this kind of state. The man who has virtù is, for Machiavelli, the man who is imbued with this Roman spirit, who is willing to involve himself in politics, and who makes political success his main end, but political success defined within the framework of constructing the ideal and ordered society which I have mentioned, within that actual framework, to construct it within that actual framework. We can say it is that man who emphasizes the common good. The common good in the definition that Machiavelli gave it. But he says, after all, things are so bad now, there's hardly a man of virtue left. So how can we bring about this kind of thing, this kind of regeneration of Italy, when you have a society where everybody's passions for power run wild, a society when there is hardly any renewal left? And to answer that question, he wrote The Prince, for his answer was that before you can have that kind of community, you have to have a prince who will curb man's passion for power. You will have a prince who will put down all the little despots and who will, as it were, prepare the way. You need, in other words, a kind of enlightened despotism in order to overcome the passions of man, in order to put down the despots, in order to prepare for that kind of a community. All his advice to the prince, which you will read, all his advice to the prince, his political advice, is to make the prince strong enough for political success. The advice to the prince implies a view of the world that I have already mentioned, a pessimistic view of Italy at the time. The prince must be like a lion and like a fox. He must be crafty. He must use force. All of this to overcome the passion of ruling. All this to overcome the present degeneracy of Italy. And eventually, therefore, the way will be prepared for the reign of virtue. That must be clear. Eventually, the way will be prepared for the reign of virtue. Now you may well say, what is so shocking about this? First of all, what is obviously shocking about it, that his end is a classical end, not a Christian end. To be sure, Machiavelli does not entirely ignore God. But God is, in a way, fortune. And the thing is to control one's own destiny through overcoming fortune, one's own political destiny of overcoming fortune. So that really God is kind of ruled out of Machiavelli's scheme. And what is substituted is Cicero. That is to say, in a sense, the Roman virtue of politics, the Roman virtue of political participation. This was, of course, highly shocking to the times. Secondly, his means, the autonomy of politics, the pragmatism, the realism, if you like, of his method and approach. There can be no intrinsically wrong action, really. What is given, what is always there, what is eternal, is an ideal commonwealth. But to reach this ideal commonwealth, you can use any kind of political action as long as they are successful in reaching this commonwealth. The only eternal thing about it is that your passion must be curbed. You'll never reach it unless you curb your passions, unless there is virtue in the world, and not every man wants to has this passion for ruling and this passion for domination. Now again, with this means, two words became associated. Two words which are very important for you to remember, coined actually by Machiavelli. One word is the term reason of state, a term that you may have heard often but which dates to Machiavelli. Reason of state. What does that term mean, reason of state? It becomes current in Europe from his time on. Reason of state means that the state is the highest good. In the end, it becomes any state. But for Machiavelli, of course, it was the well-ordered commonwealth. But eventually, it becomes any state. That the state is the highest good. And another word, which goes with it, which also comes from Machiavelli, is the word policy. Now, you've heard it. We always use the word policy. Policy this, policy that. But it is a word which comes from Machiavelli, and which really has the sense of the means. Policy means, in fact, that all sorts of actions can be taken in order to bring about the good commonwealth. Policy means, if I can put it perhaps a little more technically, policy means the overcoming of fortune. The overcoming of fortune. It's hopeless. Things have their own life, you know. The overcoming of fortune. The overcoming of fortune by virtue. That is what policy means. The overcoming of fortune, this change, this entire change, this world of constant change of struggle, overcoming it by means of virtue, by means of being that kind of person and having that kind of participation in government. The word policy is, of course, as you may already have discovered, the origins of the word politician. That origin of the word politician lies in the Renaissance. But obviously, with the reaction against Machiavelli, politician is a bad word. For example, in 1621, one person in the north of Europe linked Sadducees, libertines, atheists, Epicures, infidels, and politicians. It goes in this kind of road. Yes, you're all little moralists. I'm aware of that. It all goes in this kind of scheme. Politician, in other words, means policy for reason of state. Policy for reasons of state. That must be clear. But remember what later generations tended to forget, that after all, the end was a moral one, a moral society where men would be good. But the means had to be drastic, because the condition in Italy for Machiavelli seemed to be drastic. Moreover, people believed that his ideas were ruler-centered. They read the prince, but nothing else. But again, Machiavelli's end-ordered society was a republic where everybody participated. It was, in fact, the Roman Republic. And the ruler-centeredness of the prince, is for a transitory stage from the present degeneration of Italy to the future Commonwealth. Because, as I told you before, he believed that this was necessary, as the passions of man have run riot, and you first have to curb man's passions with a strong hand before you can have the reign of virtue and the reign of the good society. That too people were apt to forget later on. As a matter of fact, Machiavelli had his hero, Cesare Borgia, who tried, as whom you will read about, who tried to unite Italy. He was his hero. Cesare Borgia failed. But as a matter of fact, Machiavelli got a still worse name because of that hero, because Cesare Borgia's greatest success was when he invited all his enemies to a peace dinner and poisoned them all, and thereby managed to get control over much of central Italy. He had a still more famous sister, Lucrezia, this is quite true, who also worked that way. Now, to understand what Machiavelli is all about, there are two more things that we must say. First of all, how does he contrast to other kind of ideas of rulership, to the more normal ones that were floating about in the north of Europe, but also in the Italian Renaissance? How does he contrast? And secondly, of course, how did Machiavelli get assimilated into Christianity itself? How did Christianity itself cope with this thrust? Now, the advice to rulers of other humanists, through which you get the revolutionary flavor of Machiavelli, I think, very well, is the common Christian one. A ruler is responsible to God in the last resort, and therefore the only successful rulers must behave like good Christians. The check on rulership is not virtu, but Christian morality. There is no reason of state. There is only Christian morality. Let me illustrate it from Shakespeare, who, as I've told you already, was a dreadful reactionary. From a line of Shakespeare of Richard, his play Richard III, which makes this kind of idea of rulership, I think, very clear. Happy is the prince that has in wealth the grace to follow virtue, keeping vices under. But woe to him whose will has wisdom's place. For who renteth right and law asunder, on him at length, lo, all the world shall wonder. High birth, choice, fortune, force, nor princely mace can warrant king or kaiser from the case. Shame sueth sin as raindrops do the thunder. The check on the ruler was a moral check, a Christian check. And in common with the general Christian ideals, this might not work originally, but it will work in the long run. For example, in the 16th century, the general explanation for the barrenness of Queen Elizabeth of England, that she couldn't have children, was that her grandfather, Henry VII, had sinned grievously. And this was the punishment. Now, this was the usual humanist way of dealing with the problem. And it will remain so, to be sure, the usual humanist way of dealing with the problem. It assumes still a Christian universe where sin is punished and virtue is rewarded. It deals in this way with what I can call the central statement of Machiavelli. The central statement, which will affirm again whatever what I've said about Machiavelli hitherto. The question he asks, how can a man who is good cope with an evil world? The answer of Machiavelli is obvious. It must be clear from what I have said. He must have the end goal in view, the commonwealth, the ordered society. But he can only cope with an evil world through policy, as I have defined it. The Christian view is the opposite. This, they would say, is a silly question, because it is an irrelevant question, because no man is wholly good. Every man is tainted by original sin. And the world is not evil, because it is the world of God, redeemed through Christ. And therefore, God will punish, and God will reward. And this question is an irrelevant question. Now, did this kind of thing remain? Could Christianity just ignore the insights of Machiavelli? One can say, sure, the Italian conditions were Italian conditions, and as you will see next time, the conditions in the north under feudalism were quite different. But Christianity did not ignore it. For you can now ask a question which should already have gone through your mind. You can say, what the hell? People always behaved that way. In Christian Europe or no Christian Europe, people were always wild for power. The passion of domination, which Machiavelli writes about, was always there. And after all, the Italian despots were nothing new. A feudal lord could be just as much of a despot as, let us say, the Medici or the Visconti, whoever have you. Christianity did face it. Christianity indeed assimilated it. But how Christianity assimilated it is perhaps a little difficult to explain, but I will try to do so. This is a very important but complicated subject. And perhaps I can best explain it to you this way, that throughout the 16th and 17th centuries, you notice that Machiavelli is a swear word. As I say, if politician is a swear word, Machiavelli is a swear word as well. But you notice a certain subtle change in what theologians and others said was allowable political action. You notice a certain change. They're allowing more and more policy, more and more what we might call allowable, under Christian terms, non-allowable political action. Until, and perhaps this will explain it to you best, at the beginning of the 16th century, one quite influential man had this to say. He said, okay, there's Machiavelli, and he is an atheist, and therefore evil. But what's wrong with Machiavelli's hero, Cesare Borgia? There's only one thing wrong with Cesare Borgia. He forgot that the end was the kingdom of God. What is this man really saying? He is saying Cesare Borgia's poisoning at Sinalia is all right, the poisoning of his enemy. All this is fine. The quarrel with Machiavelli is no longer the means, but the end. What we want is a Christian commonwealth, whatever that means. It's a very vague idea. What we want is a Christian commonwealth. But to that Christian commonwealth, more and more means are allowable. Moreover, you can go to the Bible. Didn't bring one in today. You can go to the Bible. And there you will find, in a certain way, Machiavelli justified. In fact, it is Cardinal Richelieu, whom you'll hear more about, who had one of his secretaries make a kind of ledger. Here Machiavelli, here Scripture, to show how they correspond. And there is a look of wonderment on your face, because obviously you don't know the Bible. I will tell you two passages which are relevant. One is that Abraham lied about his sister Sarah, as you may remember, calling her his wife and not his sister when he was under some danger. Another famous passage which allowed the assimilation of Machiavelli is this business of Jericho, Joshua Jericho. Joshua ambushed his enemies, something which was not within the Christian morality, never considered, so there's a vast literature on what military can do, but believe me, an ambush is not one of them. But at Jericho, God, at Jericho, in the Bible, God approved of the ambush. In fact, you can say God set up the ambush. And that meant to many that you could use any kind of political means, because we would not disagree, would we, that the ambush was in a good cause, the cause of God. You have other passages. At one point, Solomon substituted copper for silver candlesticks in the temple. This was also approved. Approved by God. There are a great many passages in the Bible. So that we must say about this very serious business, two things. Machiavellian Christian morality did not clash that badly. What happened is that Machiavelli was assimilated into Christian morality in two ways. By approving more and more on the means and saying simply the goal is wrong. Goal should be Christ and God and not the Roman Republic, not this well-ordered society. And secondly, by using the Bible. This goes under a technical name, casuistry, with which I won't bother you, but using the Bible and interpretations of the Bible and passages of the Bible of this nature. There is a third that I should perhaps mention because it's relevant to the United States, and that is the sermon, it is brought out by the sermon that was preached when the Pilgrim Fathers left. When the Pilgrim Fathers left Holland, a sermon was preached to them, a sort of farewell sermon. And the essence of this farewell sermon is simply this. You must always follow the revelation of God. God's revelation is for you unlimited. And therefore, whatever revelation God gives you, you must follow. That means any opportunity that God puts in your way, you must exploit. And that opportunity, of course, can be in the Christian idea immoral. It can be almost anything. But if God gives you an opportunity, you must exploit it. And any revelation. No wonder nobody wanted to make treaties with the colonials, because you can't make a treaty with anybody who holds these ideas. That whatever revelation God may give you, that's it, you see. That's the next stage. And these are personal revelations. Now, why am I making such a point of it? It's very simple. Machiavelli is the beginning of the conscious new politics. Politics had always, in a sense, been the same. Power, struggle, it's existed throughout the Middle Ages. But this is a conscious new view of politics, a conscious acceptance of politics as a struggle for power in which almost all means are justified. We can go as far as to saying all means. One very nice Calvinist minister in France at the end of the 17th century made that statement, and a very pious Calvinist minister at that made this statement. If God were to come on earth and would sit around the table with a scoundrel, in order to deal with the scoundrel, he'd have to become a scoundrel himself. What this means is, of course, an erosion of the moral checks of Christianity. A very important erosion, in a sense, a vital erosion of the moral checks of Christianity. The moral checks which Christianity could put upon politics, these moral checks were being basically and vitally eroded. Now it must be clear from what I have said that Machiavelli was from now on an issue in European politics and in European thought. It must be clear also that Machiavelli is in a sense a climax of the secularism, the concern with Rome, and the new concern with renewal. How can you renew society? Which the Italian Renaissance brought up. Now, a few minutes ago, I contrasted Machiavelli and Luther. For while all this was developing in Italy, you have again in history, as always, a dialectic process at work. For while the Renaissance was developing in Italy, another kind of rebirth was developing in the rest of Europe. Another kind of rebirth, but also a rebirth. Contemporaneous. Luther and Machiavelli, I must remind you again, so you get it straight, you get the dialectic straight, were contemporaries. But the rebirth in the north was different, quite different. Why was the rebirth in the north so different from the rebirth in Italy. So that in a sense you can contrast the two. And you have a kind of dialectic here. Both of them will flow into a kind of mainstream. First of all, because the north of Europe still maintained largely its medieval social and political structure, and because the north of Europe medieval attitudes still largely prevailed. It was not an urban civilization. It was still an agrarian feudal civilization. And the attitudes which prevailed in the north, in contrast to the attitudes which prevailed in Italy, are extremely important. For once again, while the Italian Renaissance was a Sunday dress, while the people went with Savonarola, with all of that that I have told, the northern rebirth was not a Sunday dress. The northern rebirth was much closer tied to popular fears and to popular ideas. And indeed, the climax of the northern rebirth, Martin Luther, is a man of the people, in a sense that his whole ideas and everything is closely tied to popular fears and the popular tenure of life much more closely than these intellectuals, the humanists in northern Italy. It is for that reason that as we now go from Italy to the rest of Europe, to see the other half of this dialectic, we must once again start with popular attitudes, with popular beliefs, for these are vital to what we call the Northern Renaissance and to what will become the Lutheran Reformation. For that Reformation will truly spring from below, unlike the humanists in Italy, which were, as I said, an intellectual class, and whose ties with the people were slim at their best. And to those popular beliefs in the north, we'll come next time. Now I want to see all the honest people up here, please.